Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
It's Memorial Day, and I thought the perfect time to reissue one of my favorite Axe Files conversations, this one with Admiral Bill McRaven, the former commander of the United States Special Operations Command. In that role, he was the mastermind behind the operation that took down Osama bin Laden and the one that saved Captain Phillips. But that's just part of a very distinguished 37 years in the military. He went on to become the chancellor of the University of Texas system and has been unsparing in his commentary about our current commander-in-chief and some of his policies as they relate to the world and the military. Here's that conversation. So good to see you.
Good to be here.
I have very strong recollections of my conversations with President Obama about the service that you performed for the country when he was president, and he was effusive about that. So it's really great to sit with you, and it's great to sit with you because this is a podcast that really is about people's stories, and your story is you could not make it up. It is so remarkable, and much of it took place right here in Texas. We're in Austin, Texas, right now. You've written a book called Sea Stories, My Life in Special Operations. That's really an autobiography that's in epics, right, in stories. Tell me about where your story began, about the McRavens and your dad and your mom and...
Yeah, well, I grew up not too far from here, down in San Antonio, Texas. Now, I was born in Pinehurst when my father was stationed there at Pope Air Force Base. But, you know, as you point out, this is, you know, some people want to call this a memoir. And I guess in some respects it is a memoir. I mean, I tell the stories of the bin Laden raid and the rescue of Captain Phillips and the capture of Saddam Hussein. But really what I hope people take away from the book is that it's really about the great soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilians that I worked with over those 37 years, and really their impact on world affairs and on the success of our fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and just kind of seen through my eyes. And they are separate, you know, 18 separate stories, so you don't have to start at the beginning. You can, I think, pop in anywhere. So
yeah,
but fun to write.
But the what was really vivid was your portrait of your dad, who himself, as you point out, was a career military.
Right. So the book starts off in 1960.
Yeah.
My father was stationed in France at the time at the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe shape. And we lived in a town called Fontainebleau, not too far from Paris. And I tell the readers about kind of growing up listening to my father and his fighter pilot
buddies. You
talk
about spying on their right, their so get-togethers in the officers' club.
They would always go to the officers' club on a Friday night. And again, this was the World War II generation. So you think about them, kind of the greatest generation. These men and women grew up as children of World War I, children of the Great Depression. All the men went off and fought in World War II. So they had a lot of stories to tell. And growing up as a young boy, I would kind of sit at their knee and listen to them talk about these stories. And the stories were always, you know, I thought kind of, you know, inspiring. They talked about heroism and bravery and courage and sacrifice. Sometimes a little unbelievable, as stories tend to get. But I remember, you know, at one point in time later on in my life, and my father said to me, "Bill, life is all how you remember it." And so, as I tell the reader, this is kind of how I remember my life, the 18 stories in this book.
Your dad was a great athlete.
He was.
used to race he used to race not race horses, race against horses.
Right.
And obviously a big personality, and entered the military, as many did, in World War II.
He was playing professional football for the Cleveland Rams back in, it went from 1938 to about 1940. And I think they were getting paid $120 a week. And Dad used to get an additional $10 for doing Wheaties radio commercials. So he was making pretty
good
money.
Did he have a voice as good as yours?
Oh, I don't know about that, but it was good money at the time. And but kind of in the 1940s, I think they saw the storm clouds brewing. And as Dad tells me, he and four of his buddies decided to leave Cleveland and head to California, where they signed up for the Army Air Corps. And then Dad went on and fought throughout World War II and time in Korea. And then finally retired in 1967.
We should not cheat his story, though. I mean, he had some pretty close in engagements in World War II. He flew a British Spitfire planes. He was in North Africa and Sicily and Italy. He was there for Normandy.
Right.
What did he tell you about that?
Yeah, he as I think with a lot of that generation. They really downplayed their efforts in the war. I think they understood that there was a tremendous amount of sacrifice that occurred from all the young troops that were out there. So rarely did he talk about his wartime events as though they were something great to be lauded. He would talk about, again, the other people that he served with. So interestingly enough, while I say he was a great storyteller, they were almost more about other people. I remember one time, though, we were in France that same time during 1960, mm-hmm. and there was a Frenchman from Paris that Dad would visit with occasionally. And really, the Frenchman told me about Dad getting shot down during the war. And later on, when I kind of questioned Dad, he said, I was a little too chicken to bail out of his Spitfire. So he landed the Spitfire in France, got picked up by the French resistance, of which this Frenchman was kind of leading the resistance. Spent a couple days in France, and they managed to get him back over to England. Again, Dad didn't talk a lot about that time, but you knew, certainly didn't talk to me about it. I think amongst his buddies, again, they talked about the war effort. But in talking to me, it was really all about the other people he served with.
You start this book by talking about being a young man, kind of spying on the conversations and these stories that you mentioned that sometimes embellish, sometimes not. Did you know from an early age that this was the career that you were going to pursue?
I don't know how early I determined that, but what I enjoyed was I really enjoyed being around the folks in the Air Force, in this case, in the Army in San Antonio. I liked the camaraderie that I saw amongst my father and my mother had great friends, military spouses that were lifelong friends. And so the camaraderie, the sense of, as trite as it may sound, the sense of duty, honor, and country. They lived it. They believed in it. They weren't naive to the problems in America, but they felt that America was worth fighting and dying for. And so being raised in that environment, I saw that as kind of a noble undertaking. So when the time came, I knew I wanted to go into the military and kind of continue on in that vein.
And what did your parents encourage that?
They didn't push me into it. They let me make up my own mind. Now, having said that, when I was in high school and looking at opportunities to go to college, again, my father was at that time a retired Air Force colonel. I didn't make a whole lot of money. So
he became a labor negotiator.
He did. He became a labor negotiator in the city of San Antonio, loved that job, and spent time with what was called Model Cities in San Antonio, which was refurbishing the downtown. But so they were looking at some sort of scholarship, and my mother had hoped, my dad wanted me to go to the Air Force Academy. I was inclined towards the Navy because I had been scuba diving since I was about 13 and wanted to spend time around the water. So my mom tried to get me to go to the Naval Academy, but candidly, my grades were not good enough. My SAT score was not good enough. But fortunately, I was able to get an ROTC scholarship here to the University of Texas at Austin. And that was, a very smooth transition. I love my time here at UT.
It's interesting. You had one reference correct me if I'm getting these facts wrong, but your mom passed away.
She did.
And you were being shipped out right around that time. And you wrote something that really touched me about your interaction with your dad as you left.
Yeah.
And you said that, you know, he extended his hand and then he gave you a hug.
Right.
And that he, that was really unusual.
Well, you know, that generation, that World War II generation, they were not huggers. At least the military men were not huggers. And so after my mother passed away in San Antonio, my dad didn't know, but I was we were on a classified mission. I had actually had to come back from the classified mission, do my mother's funeral, and then head right back out preparing for the mission. Dad knew something was up, but as we were kind of heading out, standing there at the airport in San Antonio, my dad went to give, you know, our usual manly handshake, and instead we hugged, and I said, you know, from then on, I decided I was going to be a hugger because that was an important moment in my life.
Let me ask a presumptuous question that may slop over into psychobabble. your dad was, you know, the way you write about him, there was a sort of larger-than-life quality right. to his achievements and to his heroism and understated heroism and so right. on. How much did you feel? I know you were a runner right. as well. He was a runner. He was a champion sprinter. You ran distance. How much was there a competition with that? How much did you feel you needed to live up to his?
Yeah, absolutely none at all. My dad was incredibly humble. In fact, I didn't know about a lot of his athletic achievements until I was in high school, and I happened to stumble on an old scrapbook. And, you know, I mean, my dad, probably when I was in high school, was in his late 50s or something, and, you know, I just assumed he was an old man. I mean, I was proud of his military service, but I find this scrapbook, and I open it up, and it goes all the way back to Portageville High, where he was a star football, basketball,
everything,
baseball,
yes.
everything.
Yeah.
And then he was a Hall of Famer at Murray State, and then went on to play in the National the Football League back yeah. at the time. I was stunned by this because Dad had never really talked about his athletic achievements. My dad was always very understated, always very humble,
yeah.
just a wonderful father. And I think it never pressured me. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think he went out of his way not to pressure me because I was not the athlete that he was, although I was a pretty good athlete. He encouraged me to do what I wanted to do and kind of follow my own dreams. And it was and I will also offer my mother, who was a kind of an East Texas school teacher, equally, you know, strong in the right sense. She was this kind of very gracious and graceful Southern lady. Although she made sure that I made my bed every morning and did the sort of things
yeah.
that
which was great because it gave you the title of a very successful successful book. One of the stories in your book is about a coach who gave you encouragement, but it was obviously the story is more important than that because it was about how you broke a record, I guess, for the mile.
Right, high school mile.
And how you had failed and, you know, could have been discouraged. And this coach called you out of the blue and told you, you can do this, go after it. And he pushed you and you did it. And you pushed yourself to your physical limits to get this done. And, you know, it seemed like a prelude to becoming a Navy SEAL.
Right. Yeah, the reason I put that story in there, and frankly, I'm often asked what's my favorite story in the book, and I think people are surprised when I tell them that is my favorite story. And the reason it's my favorite story is because, you know, not everybody in the world is going to get a chance to go on a raid to get bin Laden or rescue Captain Phillips or get Saddam Hussein. But the point of that story is that coach called me, and again, I had not had a close relationship with him for a couple of years. I didn't even know he knew who I was. And he calls me at home the night before my last race. And again, I was just stunned by this. And he encourages me. And that inspiration carried me through the day on the race the next day. And I broke the school record. Now, the fact of the matter is, nobody cared about that school record but me. But it taught me that if I could break that school record, then I could go on to be a Navy SEAL. because I had set that goal and I had achieved that goal. And I realized that I had the physical toughness because the coach had encouraged me to go out and run hard. And that coach, Coach Jerry Turnbow, he and I have a great relationship today. This is the sort of thing that everybody can do. Everybody can encourage some young man or woman to go do something, and that will fundamentally change their life. And as I've told Coach Turnbow a couple of times, that phone call put me on the path to be a Navy SEAL. And when you think about that path, and over the course of my career, the folks that I have hopefully positively influenced, well, a lot of that is a result of that one phone call from Coach Turnbow.
You know, you talk about the SEAL training in Coronado, and I knew something about this. Mark Lippert, who was had various national security roles in the Obama administration, trained with the SEALs.
I know Mark well.
And he described some of it. And I thought he was embellishing, but apparently not. But you read that, and you think, man, if you treated prisoners the way the SEALs are treated, you'd violate the Geneva strictures and you know, all kinds of international law. It is an ordeal.
It is an ordeal, but recognize that everybody volunteers to be a Navy SEAL, and I think you know going into it that this is going to be, you know, some of the toughest military training in the world. And the expectation, certainly when I went through in 1977, all of my instructors were Vietnam veterans. And they wanted to make sure that the guys coming through were going to meet the standard of excellence, both the physical standard, the mental standard, the toughness, the mental toughness that they expected, because they didn't know whether or not we were going to be heading back into conflict soon. It was trying. But of course, I also tell people I was young. You know, I was 22, and when you're 22, you feel a little bit invincible. I was pretty physically fit, but it was 6 months of being cold, wet, and miserable every day, of being harassed every day, and you learn that the only way to get through is to tell yourself, I'm just not going to quit. I'm often asked by, you know, young potential SEALs, you know, what's the secret to training? They said, you know, should I run more? Should I swim more? I said, no, it's easy. You just don't quit.
Yeah, and they gave you lots of encouragement to quit. One of the games that were played with the SEALs was that they'd expose you to like extraordinary privations and really brutal physical challenges, and they'd encourage you to quit. If just five guys quit, we can stop. Right now,
we have a special week. So it's 6 months long. In the first 10 weeks, the first phase of training, we have what's called Hell Week. And Hell Week, when I went through, was 6 days long. And within Hell Week, if that's not bad enough, they have generally on Wednesday, you go down to the mud flats, which was this muddy slough of water that ran off from Tijuana and San Diego. And, you know, the mud is cold and wet and miserable, and you stay in the mud a lot. And this is really what breaks a lot of guys. And to your point, you get down there and they know that when the trainees are in the mud, that this is the most exhausting period of time they're going to have probably in all of SEAL training. And so they try to pit the class against each other. You know, everybody can come out of the mud, get warm by the fire, if only five guys quit. And so you have to stay together as a class. You have to bond in a way that is meaningful. And if you don't do that, then the class falls apart. They want to find out who's tough enough to make it through Hell Week, make it through that period of time in the mud flats. And yeah, it's pretty excruciating. But then you compare all the rest of your career to whether or not you were as miserable as you were during Hell Week.
Yeah, I guess like a third of the people who started.
So we started with 110. I think we actually started with more than that. But the records show 110, and we graduated with 33.
Yeah, yeah. Early in your career, you actually had a setback in that you had been deployed to the Philippines. You were a junior officer. You were assigned to form SEAL Team 6, which became famous in the future, and you would have something to do with it. But you ran afoul of your commander, and you were relieved of your command. What happened?
Well, so I got there actually about a year after the command stood up, and in the year that I was there, eventually the commanding officer fired me, relieved me of my position. And of course,
the words were their leadership styles clash.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I just think the commanding officer had kind of a different view of what his expectations of my leadership would be. And he was commanding officer. So he didn't like my style. I was probably a little too buttoned up for him. I had a little bit stronger belief about good order and discipline and what the guys needed to do to kind of stay on the right track. But at the time, I think he was trying to create a culture, and maybe rightfully so, of folks that were a little bit more bold and cavalier in how they approach things. So we came to a crossroads, and he didn't think I was right to be on the team, and I got fired, basically.
Asked you to do things that you thought were improper?
I thought were improper at the time, and probably, again, not conducive to building the kind of SEAL team that I thought we needed to build. Now, again, I was a young lieutenant. He was a Navy commander, considerably senior to me, considerably more experienced. He was a Vietnam veteran and a good guy. I don't necessarily fault him for the decision there. But, you know, when you get fired, that's never a good thing. When you get fired in the Navy, it's particularly bad. And when you get fired in the SEAL teams, it's really bad because it's such a small group. The point I tried to make in the book is, I got fired, and of course I had been married for a while at that point in time, and I thought I've got no career left. And my wife came to me and she said, "Look, you've never quit at anything in your life, and now's not the time to start." And so I kind of pushed through that rough period in my life and went on, and things turned out okay.
What did you learn from that?
Well, yeah, I learned that one, you are going to have rough periods in your life. We're all going to have rough periods in our life. And I talk about in a previous book about never ringing the bell. So in SEAL training, the way to quit is you have this brass bell and all you have to do is ring the bell three times and that's it. You're out. You quit. It's easy to quit. It is easy to find excuses not to press on, particularly when you're trying to do something you really want to do that is challenging. And so you have to steel yourself for these tough moments. And when those tough moments come, you have to get through them somehow. And generally, there's light at the other end of the tunnel. So I tell folks, look, unless you're in an abusive relationship or you have abusive behavior, if you're following your dream, if you're trying to do something you really want to do, then don't ever ring that bell.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. You went off onto the Naval Postgraduate School, and you actually you sort of wrote the book on special ops and the use of these forces. 612 pages. Yeah, tell me about that. What? Tell me about the fundamental principles that you.
So the fundamental principle was, when you go through the Naval Postgraduate School, you kind of start with basic military strategy 101, and you have to read Carl von Clausewitz's book on war. And it really is kind of considered the Bible, if you will, for military warfare. And Clausewitz says, look, that the defense is inherently stronger than the offense, because the defense only has to preserve and protect, while the offense has to impose its will upon the enemy. So in order for the offense to be successful against the stronger defense, you have to have mass and maneuver. So you have to have a lot of troops, and you have to be able to maneuver on the enemy. So it raised the question, then, if that is the case, why are special operations successful when we are generally a smaller force going against a heavily armed, heavily protected, bunkered force in many cases? Why are we successful? So the book set out to find out, what is different about this? What are the principles of special operation that are fundamentally different than the principles of conventional warfare? And so I did 8 case studies, actually did 10 of them. But I remember in particular, I was talking to a German officer who had been on the raid on Abenomail. One of the very early raids, German paratroopers went into this fortress. There were a couple hundred German paratroopers against 1,200 Belgian soldiers in one of the largest forts of its time. And they completed the mission in about 25 minutes.
Hmm.
So as I'm talking to him in his home in Germany, he says to me, "Well, you're trying to develop a theory here, right?" And I hadn't thought about it being a theory, but I realized he was right. I was trying to figure out why are special operations successful. That model, the special operations model, I subsequently went on to use almost every single day in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so the theory proved out over time.
Not only there, but in the planning of the raid that ultimately yielded bin Laden.
Absolutely. I mean, I took the The book I had written, I sat down with a ground force commander and I said, look, we need to figure out where our point of vulnerability is. You know, where do we achieve relative superiority? What is our timeline? I followed the model that that I'd built 20 years earlier.
You, one of the gripping stories here and hard to read in some ways is your own injury, which happened during a training exercise where you parachuted. You were leading a group and you right. were the last guy out and you parachuted because the SEALs, they need to come by air or by sea. Right. They dive, they parachute. But this one didn't go right.
Yeah, it didn't go right at all. So to your point, it was just a routine parachute jump. So we had launched out of North Island Naval Air Station on a C-130, went up to about 13,000 feet. It was one of these kind of beautiful days in San Diego. Not a cloud in the sky. We jumped out, and there were a couple of guys below me. My responsibility as the jumper above is to look out for them. But frankly, I wasn't paying attention. Guy got underneath me. He opened his parachute. So in relative terms, I'm moving at 120 miles an hour, and he stopped. I hit his parachute, kind of spin out of control, pull my ripcord. Again, I probably should have gotten stable first. I pull my ripcord. Pilot chute wraps around one leg. Riser wraps around the other. So I'm entangled in my parachute, you know, falling towards the earth, thinking to myself, yeah, this doesn't look too good. The good news is the parachute opened.
That isn't exactly what you said, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but the good news was the parachute opened. The bad news is when the parachute opens, it blossoms. And one leg went one way and one leg went the other, and it basically snapped me in two, broke my pelvis by about 5 inches, ripped the muscles out of my stomach, my back, and kind of fractured my back. And I landed a couple miles from the drop zone. Now, I'm quick to point out, I think, in the story that, you know, my injuries and that parachute drop kind of pale in comparison to what I've seen from these young men and women that were hit in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the lesson of the story about the parachute drop is that, you know, it took a whole lot of people to kind of get me back on my feet. My wife became my nurse. Admiral Eric Olson, who was my boss, took care of me, kept me in the Navy. My colleagues came by and, boosted my morale, kind of helped me through it.
It was an ordeal, that recovery.
It was an absolute ordeal. But the point I make is, look, I don't care whether you're the biggest, toughest, strongest, smartest SEAL around. You're going to need a lot of help getting through life. And I think this is true of anybody. Have as many friends as you can. Make as many colleagues as you can. You know, help strangers and they will help you. That, to me, was the lesson of my parachute jump.
You were still recovering, lying in bed on September 11th right. of 2001, and you saw these airplanes hit the World Trade Center towers. Did you, as you were watching this, did it occur to you that special ops was now going to be a more important element of conflict?
What occurred to me was that everything had changed. And in fact, I remember calling my boys and telling them, look, life's never going to be the same from here on out. I mean, this is an attack on American soil. And I didn't know which direction it would go, but I knew things were going to get challenging for us as a nation. But it didn't take me long. Probably within the next week or so, we began to realize that special operations would be a key component in this. And of course, some of the first forces into Afghanistan were special operations forces, along with our great CIA counterparts. And for the last 18 years, we've been a very, very important part of this conflict.
I want to ask you about as you read, I loved your book. The criticism of it that you hear is that you really you glorify the heroism of people who are involved, and there's no question about that, but you guys, I mean, I was around, you know, for some of this. Your assignment often is to go and kill people,
right.
I presume you've done some of that yourself. What is, do you become desensitized to that? How do you, you know, you, I understand that the principle is you take the lives of people who are trying to take the lives right. of others. But you're still killing people.
Yeah, no, it is a challenge. You know, you have to take warfare seriously. If the nation has decided to go to war, then we better go to war to win. And unfortunately, in warfare, it's going to mean killing the enemy. And of course, you don't always get it right. And I'll be the first to admit, we didn't always get it right. You know, sometimes in the nature of, particularly an insurgency, you're striking a target that you think is only bad guys, and it turns out that there are some innocent civilians in there. And that is it's a terrible thing, and that weighs on you tremendously. But you hope what you are doing, and I know the warrior culture hopes that what we are doing is, in the long run, we are protecting what is good and honorable and noble and the values of this country. If we're not doing that, then it makes fighting these wars that much more difficult. If we feel we're not the good guys, then the burden these young soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilians that were with us, the burden they will bring back when the war is over will be unimaginable. I think when you look at World War II, and again, it's not that the veterans coming back from World War II didn't have issues as well, but they knew they were fighting the Nazis. And this gave them, I think, the internal moral strength to push forward.
That one was not ambiguous.
And these wars, of course, have been a little bit ambiguous. But you go in saying, look, I have an obligation. You raise your hand and say, you know, I support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And when the commander-in-chief and the people of the country send you to war, they don't want you to do it half-baked. They want you to get in there, defeat the enemy, and get out as quickly as possible. Obviously, that hadn't worked out in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly not in Afghanistan. But you can't go in half-hearted. Yeah, that's tough. It's not for everybody. That's why we kind of today have a volunteer military. And it weighs on these guys every single day because they are husbands, they are brothers, they are fathers, they are mothers. We have women that are with us, and daughters and sisters. So it's challenging. War changes you no matter who you are.
You were in Iraq from almost the very beginning. I want to get back to your NSC. You did two years in the White House, and I'm going to get back to that in a second. But since we're on this subject, you were in Iraq. In fact, you oversaw the operation that captured Saddam Hussein. I want to ask you one thing about that, which is you spent weeks around him. You wrote that there was a lot of psychological positioning both ways, I guess. But what was your strategy in dealing with him, and what was your impression of him?
So we captured Saddam in December of 2003, and the great Army Special Operations guys who were working for me under Lieutenant Colonel Bill Coltrup kind of led that operation. But I held on to him for 30 days. And, of course, we had an obligation under the laws of the rules of engagement, laws of armed conflict. We took good care of Saddam. But on day one, or maybe day two, I guess, when Ambassador Bremer brought some of the Iraqis over to meet with Saddam, it was clear that Saddam was still pompous and arrogant. I'm sure
these were leaders of the Iraqi resistance.
Correct. Again, Iraq had fallen. These were going to be the new leaders of the Iraqi government. And they come into the room, and they are yelling, and they are spitting at Saddam, and they are calling him names. And he's sitting on this cot in the orange jumpsuit, and he is he's kind of motioning to them, hey, take a seat, boys. I still got this. You know? Mm-hmm. And they did. You could tell they were terrified of him. They were yelling at him like the schoolyard bully, but they weren't getting close. And he was, again, he had this sense of arrogance about
swagger.
Him. It was just stunning, to be honest with you. So I told Ambassador Bremer after that, not going to be any visitors. So for the next 30 days, we kept him not in isolation. He had a very nice, as nice a room as any of my soldiers did. But I had a medic and a security guard in there 24 hours a day, just to make sure he didn't harm himself. And frankly, he was an old man and he had some medical issues. But an interesting thing happened as time went on. You know, over the course of the days and the weeks when he no longer had his palaces and he no longer had his generals and he no longer had his handmaidens, he really just became a pathetic old man. And I tell folks, if you contrast that with a guy like Nelson Mandela, who almost 30 years incarcerated, and he comes out as strong, maybe stronger, because Mandela had this great character, this great sense of personal integrity, and he was able to last over this incredible period of time.
27 years,
And Saddam, within a couple of weeks, reverts to just the pathetic old guy he is because he was evil on the inside. He was nothing but a bully. And those traits came out very quickly. That was what to me was pretty stunning, was how quickly the man that had been the dictator of Iraq, just became a shell of himself.
So one of the things that you had interrogators who were coming in and right. dealing with him. One of the things they were trying to ascertain is where were these weapons of mass destruction that were the genesis or the rationale for the attack on Iraq. They never were found.
Right.
He never and one has to conclude that they weren't there.
Right.
We're now, we're back in Iraq 18 years later or 17 years later. What has the cost been, beyond the $3 trillion of right. these wars and the loss of thousands of men? And do you, looking back, believe that it was the right decision?
Yeah, I think, time will tell. And I know that sounds like a little bit of a cop-out, but as I have kind of thought through this, because you do think through it, and the soldiers on the ground think through it. I tell the story every once in a while. Late in 2010, in the summer of 2010, President Obama had made the decision that we were pulling out of Iraq in January of 2011. So we only had about 5 or 6 months left. And I was down in Baghdad, and my guys were still going out every night chasing al-Qaeda in Iraq, trying to stop vehicle-borne IEDs, trying to stop these mass murders in the bazaars. And one of the senior chiefs raises his hand and said, "Sir, what are we doing? Why are we still going out every night, risking our lives, for what we're pulling out of here in 5 months?" And again, I had thought about the same thing. And the only thing I could tell him at the time was, look, we don't know what our actions, the cascading effect our actions will have. If we go out tonight and stop a vehicle-borne IED from killing 100 people in a market in Baghdad, we don't know whether or not one of those people that was saved will not go on to cure cancer, will not go on to find us renewable energy, will not go on to be the next Iraq president of Iraq. So you got to do your job. The American people have sent us here to do our job. And yes, we can look back on it retrospectively and ask whether or not it was the right thing to do. But in the moment, if you begin to question the decisions too hard, it will be difficult to do your job.
Yeah, it would be. And I understand that from a military standpoint. But you're also, you have a kind of scholarly view of things. President Obama, when he was not even a U.S. senator but was running for the U.S. Senate, made a speech when the Senate was voting on the authorization of military force. And he said that he feared an engagement of undetermined length, undetermined cost,
sure.
and undetermined consequences that would unleash sectarian warfare in Iraq and make America more of a focus of terrorism. All those things ended up happening, did they not?
They did, yeah. I can't deny, not my intent to deny or debate what has happened on the battlefield and what has happened around the world. Personally, I wish we hadn't gone to war in Iraq, candidly. But when you're sent there to do the job,
yeah, back sure, I understood
the warrior culture. But I also think that it remains to be seen. 50 years from now, if you don't have a Saddam Hussein there, and you begin to build a stable Iraq, and the Kurds have become a great and functioning society, and the Iraqis have become strong, then will we look back at it differently? I don't know.
We're going to have another podcast in 50 years.
Yeah, I think so.
And talk about it.
But, we went into Afghanistan for, I think, all the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And we're still there in Afghanistan. So
do you think that President Obama made a mistake by withdrawing all the troops from Iraq?
I don't think he made a mistake at the time. I think it was the right thing to do. Now, all the troops, I do think it would have been helpful to leave some troops in there, just as I think it's important that we continue to have a presence in Afghanistan. I realize that it would have cost more lives if we left troops in Iraq. But, of course, by pulling troops out of Iraq, you saw the rise of ISIS. Could we have prevented that? I don't know. It's easy to sit here in kind of modern times and second guess a lot of these decisions. But at the time, I didn't disagree with the president. I thought it was the right move to begin to pull out of Iraq and let the Iraqis stand on their own two feet. The only thing I would have asked was we probably should have kept a little bit more presence in there to bolster the Iraqi army because they were still, you know, struggling to be stable at the time.
I mentioned that you served for 2 years at the NSC at the beginning of the in the beginning of the, that era. You little known fact were one of the author. You're when people have to take their shoes off at the airport, they should all think of you because you were.
Oh, thanks. You had to bring that up.
And take their computers out. So those were some of the things that you did there. But I have a different question, which is, you've been watching the events unfolding just in this last week. And I was wondering how you react as someone who not only served in the military, but served at the NSC, when you read, A, what the president's conversation was with the president of Ukraine, and which took place at a time when he had frozen aid, military aid that they needed, and secondly, how that material was handled at the NSC, moving it to a top secret server rather than going through normal channels.
Well, as you know, the president and I aren't going to be exchanging Christmas cards. But having served in the Bush White House and then having been one of Obama's commanders, what I've told folks consistently is, look, I didn't agree with every decision that President Bush made nor President Obama made. But I respected both of them greatly because they upheld the dignity of the office. And somebody was asking me the other day, well, isn't dignity in the eye of the beholder? And I said, I don't think so. I think when we think of dignity, the dignity of the office, it is about doing things that are moral, legal, and ethical. Ethical, follow the rules. Legal, follow the law. Moral, follow what you know to be right. And my concern with President Trump is that I don't see him following any of those on a lot of his major decisions. Part of this comes back to process. And so in the Bush White House and the Obama White House, there is a very rigorous process, as you know, for getting a decision to the president. Even something as simple as a call to the president of the Ukraine, that would have been vetted. It would have started
at the
policy coordination committee level. It would have gone to a DC. It would have gone to a PC. It would have gone to the NSC to some degree, maybe, or it would have flowed through a process. And then somebody would have come to President Trump and said, Mr. President, here are your talking points.
Yes.
And frankly, the president of Ukraine would have had similar talking points that probably would have been coordinated even before the call.
Yes.
And so it would not have gotten the president in this awkward position of, let me ask for reciprocation for something on Joe Biden. That wouldn't have happened if the process was in place to inform the president. And no president, is the smartest man or woman when it comes to the depth of some of these policies. That is why you need a process. And because President Trump seems to have foregone the process, I think he finds himself in these difficult positions. He thinks his
government. He apparently was briefed, by the way, and told, do not raise this issue.
Do not raise it, right. But if you don't follow the advice of your counselors, well, you're going to get yourself in trouble.
Do you think he is in trouble?
I mean,
do you think he should be in trouble?
I do think he should be in trouble. I mean, I think this is, this is a violation of kind of the fundamentals of the office. Never use a foreign country to affect the political outcome of our nation. You would have hoped through the process somebody would have told him time and time again, Mr. President, you can't do this. It is against ethics. It is against the law. And it is against our, moral position to be able to ask a fellow president, head of state, to intervene on something that is clearly part of our American electoral process. So, yeah, I think it is completely wrong.
And you think the Congress is doing the right thing by pursuing an impeachment inquiry?
Well, I want to see more of the facts come out. But what I will tell you is absolutely you need to hold him accountable. You need to hold anybody accountable that doesn't meet their responsibility of doing things that are moral, legal, and ethical. If you fail to do that as a public servant, you have to be held accountable.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. You must have been watching with interest when the acting DNI testified Admiral McGuire, because he is one of perhaps your closest friends.
He is.
In your book, you write about him being there when, right after your accident, when the doctors were talking to your wife and talking to you about what had happened, and he was trying to handle that whole situation and help interpret and encourage you. So that's how close he is to you. What were your thoughts when you saw him at that committee?
Yeah, I've known Joe McGuire for over 40 years, and I can tell you without question, one of the finest military officers, one of the finest public servants, a man of really unquestionable integrity, but in a very difficult position. He'd been the DNI for all of 6 weeks, I think, before he goes before the Congress. He was handed this report, as I understand it, a couple of days after he is sitting in the chair. But frankly, I think he handled the tough questions exceedingly well, in light of the fact that obviously he is there to be, a foil for the Democrats and probably a bit of a foil for the Republicans as well. I thought his opening statement was very clear, was very concise. Why he went to the Attorney General, why he had to talk to the White House, because they were the only ones that could determine whether executive privilege was in play. The other part that he made very clear was he is here to make sure that the protection of the whistleblower, he will protect the whistleblower as best he can. And I believe that, particularly if that individual is a member of the intelligence community. That's his responsibility. He understands that as the leader of that organization that he has that responsibility. He talked about the whistleblower's complaint being credible, and that we should follow through with the process. So I think he handled it magnificently.
I don't mean to ask this as a leading question, but it concerns me because I, like you, have great reverence for these institutions of our democracy. What impact has all of this? President's ongoing battle with the intelligence community, with the Justice Department, the FBI. What impact does it have on morale?
Yeah, I think it has a significant impact. I don't want to sound like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, but the rank and file of these organizations, the intelligence community, the law enforcement community, they are going to do their job, irrespective of what happens in the turmoil in Washington, D.C. So I think the American public can feel very, very confident that our intelligence community, our law enforcement community is out there doing their job. However, having said that, when you undermine the credibility of the intelligence community and you believe Vladimir Putin over the intelligence community, when you talk about the fact that the Justice Department is corrupt and that the FBI has got dirty cops in it, absolutely this affects the morale of these organizations. Why wouldn't it? I've also been very concerned about the president's attack on the free press.
That shows up in the way you've written this book.
And I made a point a couple of years ago when he first made the statement. I said, look, this is the greatest, his statement that the media was the enemy of the American people was the greatest threat to democracy in my lifetime. And I was called on that a couple of times. People said, well, a greater threat than the Soviet Union? Absolutely. We came together to fight the Soviet Union. A greater threat than terrorism? You bet. We came together to fight terrorism. But by calling out the media and saying that it is a threat to the American people, then the American people begin to doubt the mainstream media. And that is incredibly disruptive and destructive
to
this
republic. Well, I think that's the intent, isn't it?
Of course it is.
The president, I think Leslie Stahl from CBS reported a conversation she had with him where he said, I want people not to trust you so that when you say bad things about me, they won't believe you.
Right. So, again, I think this is incredibly corrosive, and I stand by my words that I do think it is the greatest threat to democracy in my lifetime.
You had, as you hinted at on the Christmas card comment, that you had a tussle with the president earlier when he went after John Brennan, a guy both you and I both know. I used to joke he was the Homeland Security person at the NSC when I was in the White House. I used to tell everybody I slept well at night knowing that John never did. Just a very honorable guy. He's been very outspoken in his criticism, and the president sought to take the security clearance away that former directors of the CIA are, and others in high positions, including yourself, are accorded. And you asked to have yours revoked in protest.
Well, to your point, I've known John Brennan a long time. One, I take my friendships very seriously, and John's a good friend. But more importantly, you know, John has worked for like 8 different presidents. He is not political. And as a former director of CIA, the former being the operative word, he absolutely has a right as a private citizen to criticize the president or anyone else. Now, you may or may not agree with his criticisms, but he certainly has the right to do that. And for the president to threaten to take his security clearance away as a little bit of a threat to ensure that he stops talking, one, bad approach to take with John Brennan. But two, that seemed like he was getting bullied. And so, no, it's absolutely inappropriate.
You know, the president's response to you was that you were a Hillary Clinton fan, and parenthetically, he said you should have caught bin Laden faster.
Right. And my comment back to him was I didn't support any candidate. He also said I was an Obama fan, and I said, granted, I said I am a fan of President Obama and President George Bush, who I worked for both men. And as I've said many times, I had great respect for both of them. So the president was off the mark on that.
Tell me about them as leaders, and what you learned about leadership from both of them.
Yeah, interestingly enough, while their individual personalities are different, as you know from kind of sitting in the Situation Room, when you sit in the Situation Room, how you deal with the principals in the Situation Room, I think tells a lot about the president. And in both cases, while they're different personalities, you know, President Obama, as you know, was a little bit more reserved and thoughtful on things. President Bush, I think, had a little bit of the Texas swagger that was good, very gregarious, very outgoing. But in the Situation Room, both men wanted input from their staff. They wanted to have a serious dialogue. They wanted to learn from the people that understood the topics deeply. And they were happy to have, different points of view. That is the only way you're going to come to a good decision. So I thought, interestingly enough, on their leadership style, they both recognize that there are other people in the room that are probably smarter than they are on issues. You need to listen to those folks. You need to allow the process to work. And then, as a president, you need to make the decisions. And in the case of both President Bush and Obama, they were great decision makers. They didn't take too much counsel of their fears when it came to hard decisions. And I give them both credit. Again, whether you agree with their politics or their approaches, they were doing what they thought was right for the country, not right for George Bush, not right for Barack Obama, but right for the country. And it's easy to follow people like that.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned a really important, I think, element of leadership, which is the confidence to have other people around you, to the confidence in yourself that you're not demeaning yourself or admitting some failure by surrounding yourself with people who may have insights or understandings that you need to know and don't have.
Right. And both of them, again, at least in my experience, probably more experience actually with President Obama, but a fair amount of experience with President Bush, they both relied on their staffs and they were both anxious to receive input, even if it was contrary to their personal position.
You, two of the episodes you were involved with President Obama were the rescue of Captain Phillips, which became a major motion picture. And I remember, one of my memories of being in the White House was someone just telling me sort of parenthetically, they just walked into the president's office and told him that the SEALs have the pirates in sight, but this is a fast changing thing. They think they can take the pirates out, but they might kill Captain Phillips, in the process, should they take the shot? And you've got like 10 minutes to decide. And I thought, well, I guess this is why he gets the big bucks, right? But that is the presidency. And it's also, you were the line officer who was supervising that, and you had to make those decisions and recommendations. The second one was the Bin Laden raid, and just talk a little bit about that experience and that decision to go forward.
Yeah, a couple things on the Bin Laden raid. You know, one, I give tremendous credit to CIA Director Leon Panetta.
Very effusive about him in the book, as you should be.
As I should be, because frankly, you know, if you know him, which I know you do, I mean, he is incredibly gregarious. He really has no ego when it comes to getting the job done. This could have been a CIA-only mission. But I think Panetta understood that, look, this is what we did for a living. We, the special operations community, brought us in early, made sure we had everything we needed to be successful. And so I think this will go down, obviously, as one of the great CIA intelligence missions in history. But also credit that to Leon Panetta and Michael Morrell, who really had the courage to pull the team together. But the other piece of this is the president and his national security team. I tell folks, irrespective of what side of the aisle you're on, you would have been incredibly impressed with how the president and that team handled this. I was in six or seven meetings with the president from January through April, and you know, we had heated discussions, but there was never any rancor. There was never nothing personal. It was just
because there was never a certainty
that
Osama bin Laden was in there. You were going to have to ruffle the feathers of the Pakistanis to do this mission, and this was your task. There was it wasn't clear until you did all of your work that this was even a feasible mission.
Right. All the things you laid out are exactly right. We went, every time we had a meeting, the president would turn to Leon Panetta and say, well, Leon, what do you think? Now, Panetta was very more certain, I think, than most people sitting around the table that it was bin Laden. But he had to admit that the evidence wasn't conclusive by any means. And in fact, late in the game, I think the last meeting I was in, Mike Leiter, who was the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, had been asked to review the intelligence, and NCTC came back and said, look, we think the chance that it's bin Laden is anywhere between 60% and 40%. And I'm thinking to myself, 40%? Who in the world is going to authorize a mission to fly 162 miles into Pakistan to a target that is a couple of miles from their West Point, a couple of miles from an infantry battalion, a mile from a police station. And oh, by the way, the PACs have nuclear weapons. I flew the next day to Afghanistan, got a call on Friday night from Leon Panetta, and he said, the president's approved the mission. And I remember thinking, wow, that is an incredibly gutsy decision. Because the president knew all the risks. I mean, the risks that, you know, we wondered whether or not the compound could be loaded with explosives. We'd seen this before in Iraq, where you come into a compound and the walls are booby-trapped, everything's booby-trapped. Was bin Laden wearing a suicide vest? The chance that the guys were going to get in there and get out unscathed was highly unlikely. We didn't know whether it was bin Laden. President called me the next day, and I remember saying, well, Bill, what do you think? And I said, well, Mr. President, if he's there, we'll get him. If not, we'll come home. The downside of the we'll come home scenario, as I had briefed the president, was if the SEALs arrive on target and somebody comes out and they got a gun, it's not going to go well for that guy. And if they make their way to the first floor and they kill somebody else, they make their way to the second floor and they kill somebody else, and they make their way to the third floor, and it turns out the guy we thought was bin Laden is nothing but a tall Pakistani, this will be a disaster of epic proportion. And the president still made the decision to go. Yeah. And again, one of the boldest decisions in modern times.
You remember, as I do, what happened to President Carter.
Exactly right.
When he tried to rescue the hostages in Iran, and it was a disaster, and that probably sealed his fate. I'm sure that's what a lot of people in that Situation Room were thinking.
But
in that
nobody
famous
mentioned
picture.
It. Nobody ever mentioned it in the sit room. Again, we were thinking it, I'm sure, and my guess is somewhere, you know, outside the Situation Room, somebody had a conversation with the president. But that politics and the future of the president of the United States never came up in any of the discussions in the sit room.
But the moment that it really must have crystallized in people's head was when they watched that helicopter go down in during the mission.
Right.
You had, in your book, you talk about all the contingencies that you had to plan for, and it was handled. But in that moment, and that's the picture that has become iconic of the president and his national security team in a small room in the sit room. And in that moment, you can imagine what everybody's thoughts were. But it was a gutsy call.
Very, very gutsy. And you're right, when the helicopter went down, you know, we had plan B and plan C and plan D. And of course, I knew immediately, because I'm on the headphones with the guys on the ground and watching the action unfold, that the boys were all right, banged up a little bit. But, you know, they'd been banged up before. These were all guys that had spent a lot of time in combat. They were going to get the job done.
You you served a term as the chancellor of the University of Texas system. 3 years, I believe.
Yeah, 3 years.
What's in the future for you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I'm enjoying, I hate to say it's retirement. I seem to be, I'm on the road 4 or 5 days a week, but at least it's at my own pace to some degree. I thoroughly enjoyed my time as chancellor. You know, it's 230,000 kids and 100,000 employees, and you've got, again, it is a noble mission to educate the young men and women of Texas. And so when I made the transition from the military to being the chancellor, I will tell you, it was kind of a seamless transition. I'm often asked, well, you know, go from the military to higher education and healthcare. It was great. I love the students. I love the faculty. You know, it was a wonderful 3.5 years.
Do you see yourself in public service again?
Yeah, if the situation was right, absolutely. I don't particularly care for politics, but I do like policy. And if the right administration was in place and I was offered a position that would be helpful to the country, I would definitely consider it.
You must know Jim Mattis.
I do.
What is your impression of his?
Again, Jim, one of the kind of the iconic figures of the last 40 years in the military, a great leader. I served with Jim a number of times. We were next door neighbors for many years. Truly one of the great generals in the history of the Marine Corps. And, you know, you saw that he came into the service in the country as Secretary of Defense, trying to do the right thing, which I think can be said for both him and John Kelly and H.R. McMaster and the others that came in, knowing that they have an obligation to serve when the President of the United States asks. But they also understand that when you get to the point where you can no longer, in good conscience, follow the commander-in-chief, then you have an obligation to step aside. And I think Jim did that for what he thought was valid reasons, which I think were valid reasons. And I know he'll continue to do well and serve the country in some other fashion.
I would love to explore so much more with you, but I have to say goodbye, but not without urging people to pick up your book, Sea Stories, My Life in Special Operations. It really is hard to put down once you start reading it. Your background in writing is clear. It's just a crackling narrative and an extraordinary story. Admiral McRaven, it's great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Samantha Neal, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Megan Marcus, and Ashley Lusk. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.